Welcome back. Hour number two of Hardline here on News Radio 930 WBEN, the final show of 2021. And our guest this segment is Buffalo Mayor Byron Brown. Mayor Brown, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Mayor Brown, there's some news that's been coming down over the last few hours, and wanted to get your take on it. Buffalo Police Commissioner Byron Lockwood is stepping down in February. What are your comments on that?
Commissioner Lockwood served our city extremely well. He's a more than 33-year veteran of the Buffalo Police Department. Very sad to see him retiring. He's done an excellent job, but we have a deep bench in the Buffalo Police Department, and we will continue to work hard to deliver excellent public safety services to the residents of our community.
Now, Mayor Brown, on Friday, we've been talking since the windstorm about the Great Northern Grain Elevator after the damage that was sustained. And on Friday, the City of Buffalo gave ADM the permission to tear it down. Where are we with that this morning?
The Great Northern Grain Elevator, a historically significant structure, unfortunately, due to significant damage from the windstorm and a thorough inspection done by the Commissioner of Permits and Inspections, the Commissioner of Fire, they believed from their investigation with their staffs that the building represents an imminent danger to the community and ordered an emergency demolition. Because of a building of that size and magnitude, it could take weeks before the demolition actually begins, and it could take up to 6 months for the demolition to be completed. Now, separate from the action of the commissioner to order the demolition, I have had conversations with Archer Daniels Midland. I've asked them to consider the historic significance of the building and to preserve all or parts of the structure, and they are considering that.
Have you heard from preservationists? Have you heard since we heard from you on Friday? Have you heard back from some people in the community?
Yes, we have. We've heard from preservationists and others in the community who are unhappy that the building might be demolished. They don't want to see the demolition of this significant historic structure. And so it is our hope that ADM, a multinational corporation that is extremely well-resourced, will also recognize the historic significance of this structure and make the decision to preserve all or part of it.
Now, ADM is in the building right next to the grain elevators. Do you know at this time what their plans may be if they do tear the grain elevators down? Do they have plans to put something on that property?
We have not been told that they have plans to put something else on the property. They employ over 100 people in Buffalo currently. As I indicated, they are an extremely large global corporation. They are called the supermarket to the world, so they are extremely well-resourced. And we are hoping that they will fully consider the request that has been made to preserve the structure.
And have you heard back from ADM when you asked about preserving some of the building, all of the building? Have they commented on the potential of that?
Have not heard back from them yet. I am pleased that they were willing to entertain and consider the request. They recognize the historic significance of the structure. I think now the Great Northern Grain Elevator is probably the last remaining structure of this type in the United States of America. ADM recognizes that, and so we are hopeful that they will decide that the building is worth preserving, and they will preserve all or part of it, so people can continue to see the grain milling history, not only in Buffalo, but in our country.
Would there be any situation where the city of Buffalo would get any kind of control over that building?
The city of Buffalo would not want to step into financial liability for the structure. This is a challenge that we deal with from time to time. There are numbers of historic structures or significant structures in the city that are privately owned, that are owned by private owners who have the responsibility of maintaining those structures or protecting and preserving those structures. Oftentimes we get into situations where private owners do not do what they're supposed to do, don't have the resources to protect, preserve, maintain structures, and the city really avoids placing that liability on our residents.
I know Congressman Brian Higgins was very vocal about this last week when we were seeing what was going to happen with this. Has he reached out to you? Have you two spoken about this in the last week?
Congressman Higgins and I have not spoken directly about this. He made his position and his thoughts public. I am not unsympathetic to his position. He mentioned the potential of historic tax credits for the structure. I agree with him. There is the potential that there could be significant historic tax credits that could be utilized for this structure. What the amount is, how that would be applied at this point, I don't really know, but that would be all part of the consideration that we would ask ADM to apply to their decision-making process as to preserving the structure.
Now, Mayor Brown, as I mentioned, this is the final hard line of 2021, and obviously one of the big political stories was your reelection here in Buffalo. So as you get ready for your fifth term as mayor of Buffalo, what are you looking forward to in the new year for the city of Buffalo?
We're looking forward to continuing to build the city, to accelerate economic development, to make sure that we are seeing development in every section of our city, increase, speed up. We want to create more jobs for the residents of the city and region. We have ideas for how to do that. Currently, as we speak, already in 2021, there has been over $540 million of development. We expect to increase that in 2022. Going forward. So we're looking forward to a prosperous new year. And one of the things that we want to continue to do is work with federal, state, and county government on getting through the COVID-19 pandemic, making sure that our residents are safe. And our goal is to be one of the communities in this country that recovers the most quickly from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Speaking of COVID-19, we talked with Kevin Hardwick in the last hour about the testing vote in the county. At a city level, what do you think of making COVID tests more accessible to residents of Buffalo? Free COVID tests, I should say.
Well, in Erie County, the mandate for the delivery of health services rests with Erie County government. The county and the state and the federal government, for that matter, have partnered very closely. The city has worked with county, state, and federal government. We have in the past worked together to offer free testing, to offer vaccination to members of the community. That needs to continue to happen. There needs to be resources for testing and vaccination. I think the magnitude of the costs probably exceeds the resources of county government, potentially even state government. So there continues to need to be federal assistance, not only for our community, but communities all across the country.
And looking to next year, obviously, as you said, Mayor Brown, COVID will be the main thing, but we also are seeing at a county level the Bills' new stadium being mentioned, and obviously Orchard Park and the city of Buffalo being mentioned. As the mayor of Buffalo, what kind of push would you make for a stadium in the city of Buffalo?
Well, I think I've been very clear on this. I think the number one priority for our community is to keep the Buffalo Bills in our community. I think where they physically play is not as important as keeping the Bills in our community. And I think the longer the stadium negotiations go, the greater the potential is that we could lose the Bills in our community, and I do not want to see that happen.
So refreshing to hear you say that, because I agree. You know, as much as I'd like to see, I want to see the team stay here, and I agree. If they continue talking about it, who knows what could happen. But with that said, if Buffalo was looked at, if Buffalo was considered, would the city of Buffalo be ready for an NFL stadium?
Well, you know, certainly as mayor of the city of Buffalo and as a resident of the city of Buffalo, I'd love to see a stadium in the city. There are a number of complications. One is an additional $1 billion at least in cost. Another complication is traffic. The city is densely populated. We just saw our first population growth in since 1950. We're now a city of over 278,000 people, 60,000 people getting into downtown Buffalo and out of downtown Buffalo for a game can present some challenges, certainly more so than Orchard Park, that is not a densely populated community where these games have been played for more than 50 years. So could we handle it? Yes, we could, but there would be a lot of things infrastructure-wise in terms of displacement of residents and businesses that would have to happen for a stadium to be built in the city of Buffalo.
And also looking toward next year, actually looking toward the day that we ring in the new year, New Year's Eve, how is the planning going for the New Year's Eve celebration in downtown Buffalo that is making its return this year?
The planning is going well for ball drop and fireworks display in downtown Buffalo. We've done this for many years in the city. This will be my 15th year involved with it. The only thing that we're watching and watching very closely is COVID-19 infections and the impact that could have on our community. So we want to just remind people, if we are able to go forward, people should consider being vaccinated. We're recommending that anybody coming down needs to be vaccinated. If you're vaccinated, you should get your booster. And if you're coming down with young members of the family as young as 5 years old, they should be vaccinated as well, to keep individuals, families, and our community safe. An event like Ball Drop, where you could see thousands of people coming to downtown Buffalo, could become a super spreader event. So that is one of our major, major concerns for Ball Drop. We do not want to see that happen, and we will not go forward if we don't think we can do it safely.
So all eyes on those case percentages that are coming in right now, Mayor Brown?
All eyes on the case percentages and the guidance from the federal, state, and county governments.
Is there any situation where the event could turn into a vaccine only? I do realize it's outside, but where that space right in front of the ball drop could be a vaccine only if cases continue to rise?
We haven't contemplated that. I don't know if we would have the resources to even monitor or enforce vaccine only. What really needs to happen in the city of Buffalo, in Erie County, in Western New York, in the state of New York, and across the nation is people need to make the decision to get vaccinated. That is the way we as a community, we as a nation, will get through COVID-19. With people resisting getting vaccinated, that creates the potential for continued community spread.
Well, Mayor Byron Brown, I thank you so much for joining me this Sunday. Congratulations on your fifth term, and I look forward to speaking with you in the new year.
Thank you very much, Joe, and go Bills.
Go Bills. That's right. Big game in about 90 minutes. That is Mayor Byron Brown. Speaking of many things going on in the city, but including that grain elevator that the city has given permission for to be torn down by ADM. We'll see how that plays out. Obviously, you're going to have some people push back. You're going to have some plans, but we'll see what happens. As of right now, ADM does have that permission, and you heard the mayor talk about it. If you missed any of that interview, it will be available on demand at WBEN.com and on the Odyssey app. When we come back, Dave Leventhal from Business Insider on a five-month investigation into members of Congress. We'll talk about that here on WBEN. Welcome back. It is Hardline here on News Radio 930 WBEN, the final show, the final segment of 2021. And what better final guest of 2021 than Business Insider's Dave Leventhal. Dave, good morning.
Oh, good morning. You flatter me, Joe.
Now, Dave, before we get to the main thing we want to talk about here this morning, I do have to ask you about some breaking news or developing news, and that is West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin voting against the Build Back Better. Does that mean that this Build Back Better is done for good?
Never say never, say never, say never here in Washington, D.C., but this looks to be the closest thing to a death knell for the Democrats writ large and for Joe Biden's agenda on this particular issue, as it probably gets. Now, in a way, this has been telegraphed for months. Joe Manchin has been incredibly problematic for Democrats. But as we've talked about before, and we've been talking here in Washington, D.C., also for months, this wasn't so much a Republican versus Democratic issue as it was Democrat versus Democrat. And this was an intramural fight for a long time here, and it's reached its conclusion quite potentially here today, and this would be just an absolutely massive, massive defeat for Joe Biden on an issue that was about as central to his presidency as anything going on.
So what's next for Joe Manchin now that, I mean, he is still a Democrat, now that all eyes of the Democrat Party are on him, what's next for him as a senator?
It may just be status quo. He said so far that he has no intentions of becoming an independent or becoming a Republican. Of course, these things can change. But at this point, he seems to be very much liking and even loving his position as really the mini president of the United States. Joe Biden has to go through Joe Manchin in order to get so much done. And this really just strikes back to the narrowest of margins in the U.S. Senate. If there is anything Joe Biden does want done, he's got to have effectively every single Democrat on board in order to push it forward, or he's got to rely on getting some help from the Republican Party, which is very, very unlikely to help him any more than it has to. So as a result, Joe Manchin is just kind of at least from a political standpoint, Joe, sitting pretty and doesn't really have to do anything except be Joe Manchin.
So, you know, all the talk is Joe Manchin. Had Senator Kristen Sinema, had she changed to a yes vote on this bill?
Well, it seemed like she was closer to a yes than she was a no, and we have some members of the Democratic Party, or in one case, independent, Bernie Sanders, who caucuses with the Democratic Party, saying, we need to get everyone on the record. If Joe Manchin is going to torpedo this, if he is going to sink this whole Build Back Better plan that Joe Biden has, then we're going to have a vote anyway, and he's going to have to stand there and cast his vote and do it in front of the whole United States of America. So it remains to be seen whether that actually will happen or if the Democrats are going to fold their hand and go home at this point. But I expect that there could still be some significant drama and that we will get real answers to that very question that you posed as to whether it's Kyrsten Sinema or anyone else, where they truly do stand on this vote.
All right, Dave. Now, Business Insider, it's a five-month project. I saw you on Washington Journal talking about this. Conflicted Congress. What was the investigation? How did this start? And where are we at now, 5 months in?
Well, 10 years ago, and when Barack Obama was president, in a very bipartisan fashion, Congress approved a law, and President Obama signed it at that point, that was going to serve, at least as they conjured it up, as a defense against corruption in Congress. It was called the Stock Act, and that stands for Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act. And really what this was, in addition to being a defense of corruption, it was going to try to prevent conflicts of interest in Congress where lawmakers were acting in very public ways, taking votes, writing policy, but yet when it came to their personal finances, were often investing in individual companies that would spend millions of dollars lobbying the federal government or had billions of dollars worth of federal government contracts all tied up. So you could see where there could potentially be a conflict of interest in that case. And our project looked at exactly what had happened with that law 10 years on. And what we had found, Joe, just to give you one highlight, is 52 members of Congress and counting that we found this year violating the provisions of the Stock Act, especially disclosure provisions, and about 182 senior-level congressional staffers who did the same. Much of this information was incredibly difficult to obtain, especially on the staffer end. We spent hundreds of hours up on Capitol Hill digging through records, and in some fairly profound ways is bleak, especially when it comes to the actual potential conflicts of interest that we did find as part of this project, which I should note includes more than two dozen stories and a rating of every single member of Congress, including the New York State delegation and the Western New York members of Congress, as to how they're doing when it comes to complying with this particular law, the Stock Act.
Now, have since this study had or this report had been released, has anyone in Congress, anyone that was in your report, been asked about the findings of this report?
Oh yes, we've reached out to literally hundreds of members of Congress. We have their quotes and their reactions sprinkled out throughout those two dozen stories, but much more recently, just in the past few days, with several members of Congress have either in response to our questions or just apropos of the report itself, have responded to it. And actually, if you'll indulge me, I'll read you two quotes because it shows how things don't necessarily fall into traditional notions of where politicians stand on issues. This is a quote from one member of Congress. When we asked this member, what's your reaction to this? Should members of Congress be able to buy and sell individual stocks in companies? And that member of Congress said, we are a free market economy. They should be able to participate in that, meaning members of Congress should be able to trade stocks. Well, there might be some listeners out there who agree with that statement. They might be surprised to know that that was a quote from Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic Speaker of the House. And another quote for you. Quote, there is no reason members of Congress should hold and trade individual stocks when we write major policy and have access to sensitive information, end quote. And other listeners may agree with that statement. They may also be surprised to know that that is Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez making that statement. So even within the Democratic Party, there's a lot of division. And this is something, Joe, that is not a Democratic or Republican phenomenon. This is not a blue or a red issue. Democrats and Republicans very much trade individual stocks almost on an equal basis. And again, we have found numerous examples of members of Congress on both sides who are, for example, actively trading in defense contractor stocks when they sit on the House or the Senate Armed Services Committee. People who have been incredibly critical of Facebook or other social media or media organizations and themselves are invested in those companies. We found examples of very, very highly rated environmentalist members of Congress who buy and sell oil stocks. And we found critics of tobacco who see it as one of the greatest health concerns and public policy concerns of the country, who are invested in companies such as Morris that produce cigarettes, et cetera. So lots of different crosswinds, to say the least, when it comes to these particular issues.
You know, maybe this is just the way I think, Dave, or I don't know, but I was surprised that only 75 federal lawmakers held stock in Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, or Pfizer. I thought that number would be higher, and these 75, as your report points out, they were buying and selling them in the early weeks of the pandemic. I mean, that to me is just a clear violation. You know, when we have such a health scare, you've got members that, you know, are supposed to be looking out for us trying to get even richer.
And we've gotten a lot of questions from people saying, well, how is this legal? How could lawmakers possibly be doing this? And they say so with the knowledge that members of Congress by and large are not like you or me or most Americans, because the information that they get oftentimes is secret. It is privileged by virtue of them being a member of Congress. They are privy to information and briefings and whatnot about all portions of the economy, about all different types of events and happenstance across the country and the world that could very well give them information that could benefit them in terms of the investments that they choose to make or to not make. And so why is this legal? Well, it's legal because Congress says it's legal. When the Stock Act passed back about 10 years ago, there was a push by at least some members of Congress at that time to ban members of Congress for trading, buying, selling individual stocks for that very reason, because they felt as if this would, even if it was just a perceived conflict of interest, raise serious questions about whether lawmakers were acting in the public good or if they were acting in their own private personal financial good. But that portion of the Stock Act did not come to pass. It was not part of the final bill. And as a result, although there had been some fairly strict disclosure measures that were passed as part of the Stock Act, which require lawmakers to relatively quickly, at least in congressional terms, here Washington terms, disclose any sale or any purchase that they make of a stock, they can still go ahead and do it. So it would, in a way, Congress decided to treat it as if they were just going to be their own cop on the beat and their own referees. I know Bills fans are not too crazy about the officiating that have been going on in Buffalo Bills games lately, nor have I. But at the same time, too, imagine if there were no referees at all on the field and that the two teams were left to call their own penalties. You can imagine how chaotic that situation might be and how things might shape out. Well, in a way, it's a poor analogy, but I'll make it anyway. Congress is kind of its own set of referees. And we also found as part of this reporting, Joe, that the penalties that do exist and by law are on the books for people who violate the Stock Act, they're incredibly minimal and they're also inconsistently applied. So in a couple of extreme cases, we found lawmakers who had millions or even tens of millions of dollars worth of trades that they disclosed weeks or months after a federal mandatory deadline for disclosing them. And despite the fact that they did that, only received a fine of, wait for it here, $200. So hardly when you're trading in the millions and tens of millions of dollars, hardly going to be much incentive for anyone to comply by the law or make that a chief priority for themselves.
And Dave, I would urge anyone, if you got the time before the Bills game, to go through this. As Dave said, this isn't not something that's just attacking one side or the other. This is just looking at Congress, looking at lawmakers as a whole. It's a really in-depth investigation, a really good read. You can get that link, businessinsider.com. You can go to Dave's Twitter. It's retweeted on my Twitter. Dave, where does the investigation go from here? Is there any follow-up that's going to take place to these findings?
Yeah, well, we're continuing to follow up literally as we speak. Just this weekend, my colleague Kimberly Leonard on my team reported that there were two new members of Congress who we have discovered in violation of the Stock Act, both Democrats in this case. And we're going to continue to, especially for those who did not rank highly in our conflicted Congress index, try to determine whether they're going to be doing better, whether there are going to be new laws that are offered up. There is a bill in Congress right now that would ban members of Congress from trading, buying, selling individual stocks, but it is languished in committee at the dreaded committee level and has not emerged. We'll be tracking to see whether that changes. And I should note, too, that Western New York representatives did not fare particularly well in our rating, our conflicted Congress rating. For example, Chuck Schumer, we discovered two members of his senior staff who had violated the Stock Act. Representative Brian Higgins is rated, just like Chuck Schumer, in our grading system, borderline. We have a green, yellow, red rating system for this. So both of those, Brian Higgins and Chuck Schumer, were yellow, borderline. And then Representative Chris Jacobs, he himself had violated the Stock Act and done so to a relatively significant degree compared to his other colleagues, and actually fell into the danger zone, the red danger zone. So none of those three getting a green grade for having a solid record on these particular issues. And you can read about what they told us in our index.
Now, this, we're talking of Capitol Hill. Dave, do these kind of rules, or are there any rules that apply for people that work in the White House? I mean, obviously, not just the president and the vice president, but people of those staffs that also have, you know, access to information when it comes to trading. Is there any kind of rule that governs those in the White House?
Yes, and the Stock Act does extend to them, too. In fact, the executive branch, they are much more aggressive when it comes to these types of issues, and they have to disclose information in different ways and sometimes more quickly and more efficiently and more publicly than members of Congress or members of Congress staff. So there are two very different sets of rules, even though we're talking about the exact same type of financial activity. And the White House operates in a way as it's own business, and it can make its own rules for this. Donald Trump had different sets of rules for the White House staff than Joe Biden does, and that goes back to every president in modern history. So although we didn't look at the executive branch as part of our conflicted Congress project, we have in the past, and others have too, and have found problems for sure, certainly for sure. But oftentimes Congress is the most opaque. They are the least transparent. The rules seem to apply to them a little bit less than in other aspects of the government. And I should note, too, that the Wall Street Journal did a wonderful project back several months ago looking at the judiciary, the other branch of government, and in federal judges who had all different sorts of conflicts of interest. So that would be something that also falls very much under the umbrella of conflicts of interest, financial conflicts of interest. And I would encourage people to read that Wall Street Journal reporting as well.
And again, if you want to read the Business Insider report, Conflicted Congress, you can find that at businessinsider.com. Also at Dave Leventhal or at the Joe Beamer. I have retweeted it as well. Now, Dave, I have to ask you before we get out of here. Tuesday, the president is expected to make an Omicron speech from the White House. What are we expecting him to announce on Tuesday?
Not going to be filled with the kind of Christmas cheer that most people would want. The situation is not good. I expect Joe Biden to talk about the ways in which it is not good. And I think what you need to pay attention to is the ways in which the federal government intends to step up to fight the latest spread of the Omicron variant. Look to hear from the president about potential funding for enhanced testing, number one. Other types of activity, too, that the federal government is going to help out on. This is something, again, where, as we've been talking about since the dawn of the pandemic, the federal government does not have the power and it does not have the ability to just wave a magic wand and have everyone in the country do the same thing. This is a very jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction approach all across the country, oftentimes at the state level, oftentimes at the county or the local level, as to how we do things. One school district can deal with this in a different way than the school district the next town over. And we know that, and the president knows that. So there will be some very high-level discussions of the response, but don't expect anything that's going to be tantamount to some nationwide mandate. The president can do that in different applications. Federal transportation is one of them. Expect that OSHA, the federal government occupational health agency, is going to start to get pretty aggressive when it comes to making sure that employers are making good on their promises for vaccination. So it's going to be a patchwork quilt, and I think you're going to hear that in the president's speech when you analyze what he's saying.
Any more talk of that potential quarantine for international travel that we heard rumored a few weeks ago?
Yeah, no news at this point that I know of or am expecting, but at the same time, too, being an incredibly fluid situation, all you need to do is just pay attention to what's happening on the border between Canada and the United States to know that there is just an incredible amount of turbulence as to what the rules are going to be, whether there's going to be testing involved or not, is there going to be free travel or not, and expect the unexpected. Expect that the rules will shift and morph and change as officials try to respond to the pandemic the best they can, but when it takes two to tango, such as two different countries coming to a resolution, you can have unilateral action, and that may be the United States and Canada, and maybe the United States and its counterparts in Europe or Africa or Asia or wherever it may be, and the answers may be different depending on who we're dealing with.
You know, the president always has to do a speech when I'm filling in for Bellavia. Another question before we get out of here, Dave. You know, testing is a big thing being talked about in Erie County. We're seeing in Monroe County all these free rapid tests being made available to citizens. We're also seeing this in New York City. Where you are, do you have access to free rapid tests?
Oftentimes, it depends on where you live in Washington, D.C. I live in the district itself, and you can go to libraries and oftentimes get tests, but sometimes they have them and sometimes they don't. You kind of have the demand being the supply being outstripped by the demand, Joe. And as a result, as more and more people want to get rapid tests, they want to do and take a proactive action that's going to hopefully keep them and their families safe, especially during holiday seasons, Christmas gatherings, New Year celebrations. It's something that a lot of people want, and it's very confusing sometimes, and that's just here in Washington, D.C., as to whether you can get them, whether you can get them for free. If you can't get them for free, how much is it going to cost? A lot of questions and a lot of confusion. There's no real one single solitary way to go about that. Now, multiply that by every single jurisdiction in the whole country. You've got places in this country who've got nothing or very little, and there's no way to get access to a test such as that. You have other jurisdictions that have purchased a ton or have made them freely, widely available to the population and are in much better shape. So that, too, that falls very much under the heading of a response that is all over the map, quite literally, when it comes to how jurisdictions are dealing with it.
All right, Dave, final question. How are the Bills going to play today?
Despite the offensive line troubles that, if you're paying attention to the last few hours, we may be having, I think the Bills are locked in and that the second half of the Tampa Bay game is portending good things. I'm going to say Bills by at least 20 points and go out on a limb here.
Wow. I hope you are right. I would love to see that, Dave. Well, Dave, thank you for being the final guest of 2021. I hope you and your family have a great holiday season, and I look forward to talking to you many times in 2022.
My pleasure, my honor, and the same to you. Merry Christmas and happy holidays to everyone.
That is Dave Leventhal from Business Insider, and that is the final hardline of 2021. I hope you have a great holiday season. Enjoy these final 2 weeks of 2021 with those that mean the most to you. I will be in this chair tomorrow, 10 to 2, filling in for David Bellavia. I will talk to you then here on WBEN.